Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It was just 11 years ago that a new kind of money was first used. In 2010, a man in Florida paid for two Papa John's pizzas with 10,000 bitcoins. That translated to a total cost of $25, making each bitcoin worth just over, if I did the math correctly, 0.2 cents. Today, a single Bitcoin is worth about $60,000, and you can now use it when making electronic transactions through PayPal. You can maybe even buy a Tesla using Bitcoin. Of course, you can also use this cryptocurrency for illicit transactions like buying or selling drugs, or to pay hackers during ransomware attacks. And why not? After all, it was designed to circumvent the traditional banking infrastructure. This new form of currency exists only in cyberspace. It's just zeros and ones on a blockchain. And although some say that's what makes it so secure, others look at all that and find it incomprehensible, like me. It does require a new vocabulary. So exactly what is this new currency? How does it work? What makes it valuable? Why would you want to use it? And how will it impact normal currencies produced by governments? What will it mean to the future of money? It's complicated. So today, a primer. We're joined by Peter Van Valkenburg, Research Director at Coin Center. That's a nonprofit research and advocacy center focused on public policy issues facing cryptocurrency and decentralized computing technologies like Bitcoin and Ethereum. That's a quote from their website that will require further deciphering and explanation. We'll get that in a moment. Peter, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Carol Goforth is the Clayton Little Professor of Law at the University of Arkansas, who specializes in securities regulation. She has become a leading expert on the regulation of crypto assets and transactions. In fact, she wrote the first comprehensive textbook on the topic, in which she quotes Peter Van Valkenburg. The book is called Regulation of Crypto Transactions. Thank you for being here this morning. Welcome.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Anna Herrera is also with us. She is the chief fintech correspondent for Reuters in London, whose reporting involves banks, technology, trading infrastructure, and currencies, including cryptocurrencies. And she just happens to join us today where it's afternoon in Paris. Thank you for being with us, too. Welcome.
Thank you.
Peter, let me begin with you, because I mentioned this before we started. I feel like I'm going to be speaking a foreign language that I do not understand today. I'm going to be asking a lot of stupid questions because I just don't understand any of this. But let's dive in, because that is your mission, as I understand it, at the Coin Center, to build a better understanding of these cryptocurrencies and to promote a regulatory climate preserving freedom to innovate using permissionless blockchain technologies. Also a line from your website, which I don't understand. There's a whole show in that sentence, but given the complexities of all this and the need for this whole new vocabulary, what should the average person know about this right now, today?
Well, I think the first thing to say is, you know, the average person or yourself, Mike, you shouldn't feel bad about not knowing a lot about what some of these terms mean. One thing that we talk about pretty often, Marc Andreessen, a venture capitalist, actually said this a number of years ago, is that the state of cryptocurrency and what we call blockchain technology is a lot like the state of the internet in, say, 1994. You know, people are beginning to realize this is a thing that doesn't seem like it's going to go away. It seems like a lot of people are talking about it, but as of yet, most people don't use it day to day because it's still not too friendly from a, you know, consumer user standpoint. It's still confusing. But that doesn't mean that it won't eventually catch on and there won't eventually be much more user-friendly interfaces that help people use these technologies to do good things. And the internet is definitely something that's panned out pretty effectively. We're using it right now to do the Zoom streaming for this interview. And I think Bitcoin will also pan out a lot like the internet panned out. They are very similar. You know, the internet was this intermediary-less, in other words, a person can talk to another person without going through a person, intermediary-less communications network. And it allowed people to start their own blog or do social networking or do all kinds of things that the normal television or radio infrastructure didn't allow for. And Bitcoin is this new intermediary list, so without a middleman, way to do those kinds of things when they have to do with money or trust. If I want to send you some money or some valuable things, I can do it directly from Peter to Mike instead of going through Bank of America. That's the foundational principle of Bitcoin. You don't necessarily need to know all of the technobabble in between, but also it might be interesting to some people, and it might be good to know the risks and benefits of the tech in between.
But is Bitcoin in and of itself worth anything, or is it only worth something because I can convert it to dollars or euros or pounds or yen or something? Is that because a dollar, I can pull a dollar bill out of my wallet. It's a piece of paper. It by itself is worthless. It's only worth something because it's backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. Cryptocurrency isn't backed by anything, is it?
So in a sense, you're right. But, you know, there's a way that cryptocurrency like Bitcoin is very different from the dollar, you know? And that is the story that everyone talks about, is how, you know, there's no Federal Reserve Bank. There's no country that issues it. There is instead this online spreadsheet called the blockchain that lists all the units that have ever existed of Bitcoin. You know, it's kind of like the Fed balance sheet, except you can audit this blockchain. You can't actually audit the Fed balance sheet, but that's a whole nother topic. And so, you know, when we can all see and have faith in this mathematical ledger on the internet, we can have some sense of security that the number of Bitcoins in the world is finite, just like the number of dollars or the number of pounds of gold in the world. And then with a finite supply, only so many available, and some positive amount of demand, people want it, markets will find a price. That's equilibrium, and that's Adam Smith. There's also a way, though, that Bitcoin is more like the dollar than the money you keep in your bank account, more like that paper dollar you were talking about, Mike, in that a paper dollar is one of those things that you could give me, and we could have money transfer person to person.
Right.
When you use a bank or use any payment mechanism on the internet other than Bitcoin, you can't do that person to person. You have to trust a company like PayPal, some big tech company, or a bank like Wells Fargo in the middle. Bitcoin changed that. And just like a paper dollar, you can actually send it from one cell phone to another cell phone, and there's no company in between. There's no one to trust.
Of course, currencies, Carol, and banks are regulated, and it's probably human nature to want the Wild West to be tamed. And this is kind of the Wild West, it would seem to me, because currencies are controlled by the exchequer in Britain or by the Fed here in America. There's nothing controlling Bitcoin. There's nothing out there. Can it even be, since it's not produced by a nation state, can it ever be regulated? Because that's your area of expertise. Can you really regulate this?
Oh, there is something controlling Bitcoin. I mean, the underlying software that says, here is a finite supply. Here is the way in which new Bitcoins will be introduced into the ecosystem. It's not controlled by a government, but it is definitely controlled by the terms that underlie the blockchain on which it resides. So
okay,
it is controlled.
Stop right there. Who made that decision that there would only be X number of Bitcoins and that the software would always keep that number where it is so that we control the value of the Bitcoin? Who made that decision?
That's a phenomenal question, and we don't know. If you look way back into 2009, when you had, somebody or somebodies under the name Satoshi Nakamoto writing a white paper about a peer-to-peer system, that's a pseudonym, and there is a great deal of speculation about exactly who that was, or you know, the who's that wrote that. But whoever that was, they developed the programming. They set up the rules under which this new permissionless asset was going to trade. And they set the cap.
And what makes them unable to change that at any point in time to say, well, we need more Bitcoins. Let's put more into the system. What prevents them from doing that?
the terms of the software itself provide that it can be changed, provided you have a consensus among the people who have that program as part of their computer network. So when you decide that you want to be part of this crypto ecosystem and you want to be part of the Bitcoin, you want to be one of the people who validate, you know, transactions, you want to be a miner, all these kind of fun words, what happens is you get access to that ledger that Peter was talking about. You have access to this entire open source, the coding, you have records, all of the ledgers. Every single computer that's part of that network has access to that information. So if you can get all of those computers to agree, yeah, we're going to put this amendment in, you can change it. And you can build into the programming that it can be changed, not with the approval of every single computer, but with a group of master computers, master nodes, or you can put it as a majority control or a supermajority control. You build the way that you want to amend the software into the software itself. And you could have back doors. I mean, the programmers could build in back doors that would let them amend the code. But because the code itself is open source, people can see, right, and programmers who are far more tech savvy than I could go back in and check to see if that's something that's subject to being amended and forced on computers that agree to participate in the network.
So what I'm hearing you say is that Q is responsible for all of this. That's what I'm hearing.
Interesting theory.
Yeah. Anna, before we get to definitions, which we need to get to so people know a little bit about what we're talking about here, I want to talk about your writing, because one of the things you write about is this. And I know you've been a financial writer for a while. How long have you been writing about cryptocurrencies? And is the frequency of writing about cryptocurrencies, from your point of view, increasing as time goes on?
So I've been writing about crypto since 2013, which coincides with the first big rally of the price. And my frequency of rally tends to track the price and interest from sort of consumers. I do look at it because I cover fintech, which includes cryptocurrency. I tend to look at it also when, you know, the market is flat or when it's going down. But obviously, there's more sort of interest and more demand for stories when the price is going up, like now or like in 2016, 17, 18. That was another big sort of boom.
So the word blockchain has been tossed around, Anna, by our other two guests and by me. And when I talk about it, I have no idea what I'm talking about, but they do. Explain what a blockchain is, because that's the backbone of all of this, isn't it?
Yeah, many people ask me, especially at dinner parties during booms, and then they just space out after 3 seconds. So it's what Peter was saying. I was so glad he described it as a spreadsheet, because I kind of want to describe it like that, but then I'm worried that I'm being not very technical. So imagine it as a spreadsheet that sort of like a Google spreadsheet everyone can see. But in order to actually change it, you need to be part of the system, and you can't make changes that aren't authorized by the system. So you can't falsify the record. But the big powerful thing is that it's a constant sort of public record of each Bitcoin transaction, which is very, very powerful, and sort of companies hope that it can actually be used to track not only Bitcoin transactions, but transactions in other things. And it would be a better sort of system than having a third party auditor come in and checking your books, because it can be public or it can be also kept private. But in general, the Bitcoin one is public. So it's on the internet and everyone can check what's going on, essentially.
Anna Herrera writes about this for Reuters. We're here with Carol Goforth from the University of Arkansas and Peter Van Valkenburg from Coin Center. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cryptocurrencies today with people who really know about this. Ana Herrera is the chief financial technology correspondent for Reuters out of London. Carol Goforth wrote the textbook on the regulation of crypto transactions. She works at the University of Arkansas, where she is a professor of law. And Peter Van Valkenburg is research director of Coin Center, whose mission is to explain all this to people who need to know about Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Speaking of which, Ana, what exactly is a Bitcoin?
It's a very, very complicated question. It's essentially basically a list of numbers, right? But it has value because lots of people who now own it have decided how much it's worth. And so at the current moment, for one Bitcoin, you can get around $60,000. And you can also go, as you said in the introduction, and go buy yourself a Tesla if you want to. It's unclear whether that would be a wise move, because maybe next week the price of Bitcoin will have gone up 20%, and so that Tesla will have become a lot more expensive. So essentially, it's a sort of a digital asset. That's the way they describe it, people in the sector, and I don't want to throw more complicated words out there, but it's sort of... It's a form of money on the internet. It's a form of value for the internet, either to transact, to buy things, or to hold, like gold, to keep it so you think it'll appreciate. And then rather than having physical gold, you have digital gold. It's the gold of the internet.
I have in my notes, I went back and looked yesterday, and I can't find them right now, but the value of Bitcoin and all these cryptocurrencies changes, just as the value of the dollar compared to the pound or whatever changes minute by minute. It's like the stock market, and yesterday it was trading at around $58 and change, and I'm trying to find these others, because the next nearest cryptocurrency of value is Ethereum, and it was in the $2,000 range yesterday, and then they go all the way down to a dollar something, or some of these other crypto. What makes one cryptocurrency, Carol, more valuable than another?
It's the value is based on what people will trade that asset for. So the reason that Bitcoin yesterday may have been, you know, 58,000, today maybe 56,000, tomorrow maybe 60 or 80,000, is because that's what people will pay for a Bitcoin.
Yes, but why? So, because it was $58,000 and change yesterday. Ethereum was 2,000. Litecoin was $242. EOS was $6.53, and Ripple was $1.04. Why?
Well, that's because the all kinds of different reasons. Ripple was trading considerably higher about 6 months ago, before you had the SEC come in and say, oh, that's a security. So sometimes there are external events like the initiation of an enforcement action that will cause investors to say, ooh, that's risky, I'm going to pull back. That will cause a drop in the price of that particular asset. Sometimes there are things that are internal to the operation of a particular asset, such as a decision of a major exchange to list that particular form of crypto, making it easier to buy or sell, that will cause the value to go up. So sometimes for individual assets, there are specific external or internal events that will cause a change in value. But otherwise, all of these have a value only because people say they have a value. And that's up to the investors, of whom there are hundreds of thousands of people.
So it's really not it's really not unlike money, which is all done on faith and trust, quite honestly, when you think about it. But Peter, when I get paid to do this show, and yeah, they do pay me, when I get paid to do this show, it gets direct deposited. The money gets into my bank account. And I know it's there because the bank tells me that it's there, although I don't ever see the actual paper unless I withdraw it from the bank, which I can do because I know how much money I have in the bank. And then I can take that money and I can pay you for a cup of coffee if you serve it to me at Starbucks. How does it work with Bitcoin? How do I know if I buy it, How do I know what I have in my bank? Because there is no bank. How do I then spend it if I want to buy something with it?
So there's fundamentally two ways to have and hold Bitcoin or to receive Bitcoin if, say, you were to negotiate with NPR to get them to pay you using Bitcoin instead of dollars, which I'm not necessarily recommending, but you know, you might think about maybe some percentage of your salary in Bitcoin. So the two fundamental ways to actually have it are kind of, again, like the US dollar. You could get paid in cash. You could, you know, face to face, someone could hand you your salary in dollars and you could keep it in your wallet, and you know you have it in your wallet because you can see the paper in your wallet. Or, of course, you could do something like direct deposit, at which point you're trusting your bank to negotiate with the bank of the company that's paying you and change two numbers on their spreadsheets. And then you have to trust your bank that they actually have the money that is that you are entitled to as your salary. Bitcoin can be the same. And that's what's great about Bitcoin. Unlike other electronic payment methods where you always have to trust a bank or someone in the middle, Bitcoin can be peer-to-peer. So NPR could have a wallet on a cell phone controlled by, say, an HR person, and you could have a wallet on your smartphone. And those wallets on those phones are entirely under the control of the people that own the phones. There's nobody else out in the world that could spend the money except the people that hold that cell phone and the unique sort of password and username that the cell phone has for the Bitcoin network. We call it a private key, but you don't need to know the jargon. It's basically like the only person who can spend the Bitcoin then is you with your smartphone. Now, it also means if you lose your smartphone, you lose your Bitcoin. And that might sound weird and scary, but it's exactly the same like cash, like dollars. If you lose your wallet, your leather wallet, and it has $200 in it, you've lost your $200. You could go to the police and they'd say, oh, very sad. We'll write a report and we'll see if we can get the guys in the crime lab working on it. But you're probably not getting the wallet back.
But very few people have a lot of cash in their wallets anymore. Most people have credit cards and debit cards in their wallet. And if they lose the wallet and they lose the cards with it, you can call the bank and they'll give you a new card and they'll stop any transactions that are being made illicitly on your card while it's not in your possession.
That's right.
That is not the case with Bitcoin, correct?
Correct. If you're holding your Bitcoin directly. So as I said, there's two ways to hold Bitcoin. There's also plenty of people out in the world who start companies. Some of the notable ones are Coinbase or Kraken. And these companies are Bitcoin banks. I mean, they've got funny names, you know, because the internet likes funny names, but they're just about as trustworthy as Wells Fargo or JP Morgan when it comes to cybersecurity, when it comes to auditing, when it comes to regulation. They're all regulated by state regulators, and they basically do what a bank does with your dollars. So if you don't want to hold your Bitcoin yourself, you can hire one of these companies to open a Bitcoin wallet for you. They'll secure the unique password and information for your Bitcoin. You don't have to worry about losing your cell phone or losing your wallet. It's just like online banking, except the things in your account aren't dollars, they're Bitcoins.
Yeah.
Can I just add something? It's true, right? It works kind of the same. I think the big difference, and many of these firms are now sort of grown and sort of institutionalized in a way, but a big difference is banks are also sort of backed by the government, right? So if something happens to the bank, your deposits are sort of guaranteed. And some of these companies do have private insurance, but it's not the same. And sometimes we've seen the price crash more in previous years because some of these companies have been hacked and the Bitcoins have been stolen. And people had no recourse because, you know, they just left and they couldn't be found, right?
Some of those worst hacks, some of the particularly bad hacks, like some of your listeners might be familiar with Mt. Gox, which was a notorious hack that happened a long time ago in Bitcoin years, around 2012 or 2013. Those happened in many cases before there was better regulation of the companies that will be your Bitcoin bank. And I, you know, cybersecurity is a perennial problem. We're never going to solve it. So I won't say that it's absolutely 100% better now to use one of these companies today, but it's a lot safer because now they're actually regulated by state money transmission licensing regulations and by other systems, but they are not FDIC insured. So
I would like to, it really depends on where your exchange or your wallet service is located. I think there are some that are particularly focused in jurisdictions where there is less regulation. And if you go with one of these wallet services that kind of a fly by night, you've never heard, it's based in the Seychelles, it's based in some country that you've never heard of, you could easily find that you've lost access to that. So going with someplace like Coinbase, like Kraken, the two that Peter just named as major exchanges, far safer because they are regulated. They are trying to comply, not just with our states, but the national laws, which also help us with the illicit purposes that Mike talked about in the introduction.
And Mike, I want to come. Go ahead, Peter.
Mike, you were talking earlier about losing your wallet and you lose your credit cards, and then the company can cancel your credit cards so you don't end up having somebody else stealing your credit card balances. That's definitely a feature of modern electronic transactions, right? Some people really like the convenience that now they don't have to have $500 in cash in their wallet. They can have a credit card, which only they can use. That is a good innovation, right? But there's also a bad consequence that came with the end of cash transactions and the rise of credit cards. And that bad consequence is no more privacy and no more actual autonomy or control over your money. So when you trust a credit card company to choose when your card works and when it doesn't work, you're basically trusting them to know every detail of every transaction you've ever made because they're going to see every single one so they can know whether to cancel it or not because they think it might be stolen. And you're trusting them not to cancel your card while you're actually still in possession of it.
Right.
In a very fundamental way compared to cash, you've lost your personal liberty and freedom and control over your money and handed it over to a big corporation, which hopefully will be trustworthy. But in plenty parts of the world, they won't be trustworthy. And in a lot of those parts of the world, like developing nations where they don't have the rule of law and they have kleptocratic governments, you don't want to trust a card issuing company. You want to hold the money yourself. And Bitcoin actually allows people in those parts of the world to hold their money themselves, just like we used to hold dollars. So you can think of it as an electronic cash, as a new way to have cash and that kind of personal control and freedom over your money.
So I add one thing to that too,
sure.
Because one of the huge benefits of a cryptocurrency is not just applicable to folks in the US. This is a global asset. So we think about how easy it is to, you know, hop in the car and go down to the bank. Around the world, there are billions of people who are unbanked. And we have some in the United States. They simply can't afford the fees. But around the world, there are billions of people who, you know, it would take them 2 days, a day of walking to the bank and a day to walk back home to be able to put money in or get money out of their bank. But they have a smartphone. So they can use a cryptocurrency for transactions. They can be paid in it. They don't have to have access to a bank. So this opens up a world of transactions and finances to an entire group of people that did not have access to things we take for granted.
But how is that different from using Zelle, which is a form of transaction that certain banks allow you to use to make transactions between peers? Yeah. If you're sitting at a restaurant and you want to have somebody else give you the money that you just put on your card for their meal, they can use Zelle to do that. Anna, how is that different?
So crypto supporters, obviously the main, I don't want to say just crypto supporters, but clearly the difference is Zelle comes from your bank. So you need a bank account or you need a Zelle account, which means they need to identify you because they have to do KYC checks, you need to make sure that they can onboard you. So you're going through a third party, right? Which, as Peter was saying, you might trust or not trust depending where you are, right? The truth is, for now, if you're living in the US or in many countries around the world, we tend to trust these institutions and they come with safeguards that make them more trustworthy, right? Whereas with Bitcoin, I could just do it myself through my phone, as Peter was saying. I could just pay my friend directly. I don't need anyone in the middle. So if I don't trust where I am and I don't trust anyone with my money, then it's a better way. The reality is that in practice, people still are preferring to use traditional methods because they come with some advantages for now, right? And it's changing rapidly. You know, at the beginning, Bitcoin used to be very hard to use, whereas now you have all these companies sort of in the middle that make it easier. But then again, you have all these companies in the middle. So you're sort of recreating a lot of the system that we had in place for sort of traditional finance because it's a little bit more practical in some cases. But the truth remains that you can still do peer-to-peer transactions if you're, say you're in a country and there's a sort of, you know, there's a civil war and all of a sudden the country goes bankrupt, the banks go bankrupt, you know, it's happening. Like in Lebanon just now, the banks went bankrupt. Then, you know, you can't withdraw your cash. If you have Bitcoin, you can always take it out because you're holding it, right? So that's a big difference. Yeah, it's just a question of how often does it happen for people around the world, right?
So a lot of people who are unbanked globally are unbanked because of, you know, the complete collapse of their political system in the country where they live. So there are two examples worth pointing out in the past year where Bitcoin's been used by people who would simply not be able to get bank accounts. In Belarus and in Nigeria, there have been protests against the corrupt governments in those nations. And those protesters have been systematically cut off from the international banking system. They were, you know, Zelle would not open an account for them. No one would open an account for them. And they wanted to raise money in order to fund their democracy protests, their pro-democracy, pro-human rights protests. And they actually turned to the Bitcoin network and raised money using Bitcoin to fight their corrupt governments. So this is a very real use case. It's not going to be pertinent to somebody necessarily living in a well-functioning democracy like America. But it will be very important to people in those other countries.
But Peter, many of these corrupt governments, one of the first things they do is restrict access to the internet among their citizens. This is all on the internet. If they turn you off, then you've lost your money. You at least lost access to your money. Is that not true?
So as long as you keep your password secure, your money won't move on its own. You may not be able to get access to it until you can get internet again. Mm-hmm. But as long as you keep that password secure, no one else will be able to move it either. As far as the internet connectivity problem, a corrupt nation is going to cut off internet like full on. The whole country will be down. If they try and cut off the internet, you know, atomistically, I don't like this person, I don't like this person. There's actually ways that people can mask their internet traffic so that the government can't identify that traffic as theirs. There's a lot of ways that people who are, say, involved in something like the resistance movement in a country could still get online and find ways to connect. And, you know, this is only improving. A lot of people thought that, say, you know, we would have to wait until broadband and wired internet came to, say, sub-Saharan African countries for those countries to see the sort of wave of innovation that comes from being connected to the internet. Turned out that cell phone towers were a much better way to do it and could happen much faster. And we're seeing cell phone penetration for internet penetration into sub-Saharan Africa much quicker because of that new tech. And, you know, we can speculate that things are only going to continue to get better, and it's going to be harder for corrupt nations to cut their citizens off from the internet. Take a look at Elon's Starlink project, where he's putting thousands of satellites into space every week, basically, now. And all you'll need is a satellite in order to reach the internet. There's no nation or country or big trunk line cable under the sea necessarily in between you and the internet. So, you know, it's all a risk calculus. We got to think, like, what are we worried about? And I'd put my money on being able to access finance through the internet than through a big bank.
More about cryptocurrencies and your interface with them when we come back at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about cryptocurrencies with Peter Van Valkenburg, Research Director with the Coin Center. Carol Goforth is Professor of Law at the University of Arkansas and the author of the first and only textbook on the regulation of crypto transactions. That's the title of it. And Anna Herrera is the Chief Financial Technology Correspondent for Reuters. She's based out of London. Carol, you have written, I have 7 pages of notes of questions that I wanted to ask. We're on page 2. So we're going to have to do a follow-up program. But you have written that cryptocurrency is money, property, a commodity, and a security all at the same time. I do know that it fluctuates greatly. The value of Bitcoin at least has, and it would have been an investment if you'd bought, when that pizza was bought for 10,000 Bitcoins, if you'd kept the Bitcoins, you'd be rich, because right now that's worth about $600 million. So what is it? Is it more of an investment than it is a currency? What is it?
I think that's the reason why different regulators take a different look. You know, there's that parable of the 3 blind men who touch different parts of the elephant, and they describe the elephant, you know, oh, it's this big round thing. Oh, it's this little snake-like thing that keeps wiggling. It's this huge barrel. And none of them are describing the elephant. So if you look at the IRS and it says, okay, we need to make sure that transactions in Bitcoin are taxed, it treats Bitcoin as property. You know, it's this there's no intermediary. It's like a barter exchange because there's no bank helping you. So they want to value Bitcoin like property. The Securities and Exchange Commission says, oh no, it's like an investment, as you just explained, because people are holding it for money. They are putting something of value in and they are expecting it to go up. So it's a security. And the Commodities Futures Trading Commission says, no, no, it's a commodity because it is a piece of property, even if it's intangible. So by looking at different pieces and different attributes of what this asset is, our regulators define it differently. And FinCEN, which is responsible for regulating currency, says, you guys all have it wrong. It really is currency, because if you look at its function, it can be a store of value, like Anna said. It can be a medium of exchange. It can have all of these different functions that mimic money. So depending on how it is used and how you want to see it, it has these attributes of all these different things. And in my opinion, it has that because it really is a new asset class and deserves its own sort of regulatory regime. We just haven't gotten there because regulation always lags behind technology. Hey. And I think the mission of Coin Center, which is to make sure that we don't have regulatory systems that interfere with development and progress, is really an important mission and something I wish our regulators kept more in mind.
Thanks. PayPal is accepting Bitcoin, and one of the founders of PayPal, Elon Musk, is now the CEO of Tesla and that of SpaceX, and he is heavily invested in Bitcoin. And I think he has 58 billion dollars of his own Bitcoin. I don't know. And now Tesla is allegedly going to let you buy one of their cars using Bitcoin. And in fact, the company, I think, added $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin to its balance sheet. Why would the company do that? Why would a company like Tesla tell you that you can buy a car using a Bitcoin? What's in it for them?
All right, so first, quick cynic sort of answer as a journalist, it's good for publicity, right? Like when Bitcoin's rallying to say we accept Bitcoin, everybody's gonna write a story. So let's get out of the way. Why you would have it on your balance sheet, and there's a handful of companies, big companies that now have Bitcoin on their balance sheet, is that they see it as a hedge against sort of the what they think is gonna be a sort of devaluation of the dollar. There's been so much monetary and fiscal stimulus because of COVID and also because of the previous crisis. And so there's an idea that there will be more inflation and the value of the dollar will go down. And so you can hedge against it. And also, you know, interest rates are a record low. So if you're holding cash, it's sort of not giving you anything, right? It's just sitting there. So they think if we invest in Bitcoin, and Bitcoin has been going a lot recently, it'll generate more returns for the company. So there have been more companies doing it, but in general, sort of based on our reporting, most companies are probably going to hold off for now, because the reality is it's a very volatile asset. So you might have your balance sheet be worth 20% less than it was worth yesterday if you're holding a very large amount of Bitcoin on your balance sheet. But that's been one of the biggest things that's happened this year, is mainstream companies deciding to buy Bitcoin for themselves.
Can I say one thing about that?
Sure.
Just real fast. The other reason that some companies are putting a small amount of Bitcoin on theirs is because everybody says that the stock market itself is going to have a devaluation. And if you sort of track the way Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies have gone up and gone down, they don't necessarily track increases and decreases in the stock market. And so there's a hedge also against a risk of devaluation. If you're investing in stocks, you might want to have a small portion invested in crypto as well.
But you just mentioned the possible fall of the dollar, of the value of the dollar, Anna, and she just mentioned, Carol just mentioned how the stock market may be headed for the bursting of the bubble, because it is at all-time highs at the moment, and nobody understands exactly why, because the economy at large would not support it necessarily. And you have written, Anna, that you can now go into smoke shops in Montana, or gas stations in North Carolina, or delis in New York City, and find ATMs that allow you to deal in Bitcoin. But I can't walk up to the counter in those places and buy a bag of potato chips or a Coke using a Bitcoin. I still have to convert it into currency. Is this just like a comparative currency? I mean, the value of the dollar versus the pound versus the euro changes hourly, minute by minute. Isn't the same thing true of Bitcoin?
I think one of the biggest tensions with Bitcoin, and I've sort of been thinking about this and pointing to this from the beginning, is that it sort of means different things to everyone. Sort of Bitcoin proponents have always said, this is a currency and it's going to be a great means to transact in the future when we're transacting on the internet. Whereas a lot of people now see it as a sort of form to store value, sort of like a digital gold, so an investment, right? So there's a bit of a tension in that, in the sense that, you know, if you think the value is going to go up, why would you spend it to buy a bag of chips, right? You're going to keep it, right? But also in practice, there haven't been that many places to just go and spend your Bitcoin with. That's changing. And one of the biggest things that's happened this year and recently is that PayPal said you could now use the Bitcoin you buy with them to buy stuff on the internet in merchants that accept PayPal. And that's a giant change. What I'm really curious to see is if anyone will actually want to do it, right? Because, you know, one thing is being able to, one thing is wanting to spend.
Do you see cryptocurrencies, particularly Bitcoin, since it's the most valuable at the moment, becoming the standard against which all currencies are measured? Right now, I think that standard is the dollar, but that could change to whatever the Chinese currency is. I can't remember what it is right now. But could Bitcoin become the standard against which all these currencies are measured?
That's a gazillion dollar question. I guess we can't underestimate the fact that we know we live in a society with governments and that there are lots of interests in keeping sort of the dollar sort of as a global reserve currency, right? So, you know, they'll probably try to do something before that happens. And they are, in fact, all trying to build their own digital versions of their own currencies, like a digital dollar, a digital. And part of that is more, I guess, some of it is in response to Bitcoin. Some of it is in response to private companies trying to launch their own currencies. Facebook said it would launch its own currency, right? So I think it's sort of still up for debate. It clearly seemed like an even crazier idea, you know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And, you know, when there's a rally, sort of you get a bit confused about what seems realistic, what doesn't. But, you know, I'm sure there's people in the Federal Reserve who are thinking, well, could this happen? And if so, what happens to our fiscal policy? What, you know, it's become more of a possibility. And obviously, it's not up to me to say whether it will happen or not.
And this is also just the nature of innovation. So if you ask someone in the early 90s, what is the internet going to be for? Is it going to be for mail, like email? Is it going to be for video, like sending movie files, watching a television show or something like that? You'd get six different answers, and people with different answers would say that the other people are crazy. You can't use the internet for video. It's not enough data, and nobody's going to want to watch TV on the internet. And yet Netflix proved that was actually extremely viable as a business strategy. The internet was this open computer platform that allowed anybody to build what they thought was the right thing to build on top of it. And then eventually the market figured out that these are the good things to do with that open computer platform. Bitcoin is the same. It's this open peer-to-peer platform for money and for valuable things, for records that we want to all agree on, like how much is the amount in supply, like how much, who's paid who, the things that we don't want to trust somebody else to tell us and have to just go on faith. And anyone can build an application on top of Bitcoin because it's open source software. So maybe the applications that get built on top of networks like Bitcoin will be like stable coins. There'll be national currencies that travel on that ledger, on that Bitcoin blockchain or on that Ethereum blockchain, and they'll have a stable value for payments. Or maybe the applications that people use built on top of Bitcoin will be more like a digital gold, just a way to secure your family's fortune against people who might steal it or federal regulatory agencies that might devalue it through inflation. Any of these use cases is possible because the platform's open. And that's what's good about the innovation, not whether it ends up being one or the other.
Laura Shin is a journalist who hosts a video audio series called Unchained. And she's one of the first reporters, Peter, to cover crypto assets full time. And she said, this is truly a far superior form of money than any other money we have ever had, purely on the technological level. Would you agree with that? And if so, why? Isn't money money?
So is money money? It's a really hard question because money's been all sorts of different things throughout history. It seems like populations tend to try and find things in their environment that they can use as money that will establish trust amongst everybody who wants to have transactions, right? And the early stuff always ended up being precious metals because there just weren't that many units of the precious metals available. You were not going to normally come across a piece of gold. And so that could become a standard against everybody, everybody's expectations for what is scarce and what is valuable. And Bitcoin, as far as that scarcity, is probably the best money. You know, there could always actually be more gold. Who knows? Elon could rope an asteroid and bring it over to Earth and it could be loaded with gold. That's actually within the realm of possibility. Bitcoin, however, it's not like something you can just infinitely dig out of the earth or find in the universe. There's a finite number of Bitcoins and there's very robust cryptography that basically guarantees that. And as Carol said, everybody on the network can see the supply in every moment if they want to. It's like an open data feed, like a giant shared Google spreadsheet. And so we can all establish some sort of faith and trust in the scarcity of the unit. You can't find that kind of trust with respect to the balance sheet of the Federal Reserve or the Chinese yuan and their very opaque central banking practices. So if all you care about is scarcity, and that's the reason you want to use something as money is because you know there won't suddenly be way more of it than everyone expected, Bitcoin might be the best money. But there's lots of other metrics, like it's not going to be accepted everywhere, so it might not always be the easiest thing to transact in. And the dollar might always be best for that. In fact, I think it probably will be.
Carol, that same journalist, Laura Shin, who I referred to a moment ago, says these currencies are, here comes a new word, more fungible. That's a word that I never used and never really heard until the recent sale of a digital artwork. And this is probably off on the side. This is a sidebar issue to cryptocurrencies, but I want to bring you into this because recently this non-fungible token called Every Day, the First 5,000 Days, a work of art by a South Carolina artist named Beeple, was auctioned at Christie's for $69.3 million. I saw a digital picture of this, and that's what it is. It's a digital picture. But it's also a non-fungible token. So explain to me exactly what it is, why it's worth $69.3 million, because I could have taken a screen capture of that thing and owned it myself for free.
Well, you could have had an image of it. You wouldn't own the rights to it. Fungible simply means that, you know, is this something that if I have one of it and I have another of it, I can trade them and they're exactly the same. Like if I have a dollar bill in this hand and a dollar bill in this hand and I switch, the hands still have just a dollar bill. If I have a Picasso in this hand and a Picasso in this hand, and I switch, they're unique. There are no two versions of the thing that are exactly alike. And so if I have a non-fungible token, it means that that particular token has embedded in the software unique identifiers that make it the only one. Or a limited number of ones with some unique identifiable coding in it.
So it's encoded with its provenance, is what you're telling me.
It is. A non-fungible token really is one of these additional things that you can do with a blockchain. A blockchain, the underlying technology that lets you have this open source ledger and on which you can have cryptocurrencies, that is a crypto asset that really is designed to function like a currency, which is fungible. You can trade it, you can, you know, exchange it, they're all the same. You don't have to only put cryptocurrencies. That doesn't have to be the only crypto asset out there. So a non-fungible token is a different kind of crypto asset. It's still on the blockchain. And it works kind of the same, but it has the same kind of value because people say it has that value.
So very quickly, Anna, given the complexity of all this, what do you anticipate in terms of cryptocurrencies actually being used by average people who have to understand all this to even understand how to buy it safely?
I think they're probably listening to us being very confused and saying, I have to buy something now. I'll just use my card. That's it, probably.
Will it happen in our lifetimes? That's the question, which we'll have to come back to on another show. Anna Arera, Carol Goforth, and Peter Van Valkenburg, thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.